Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Jeff Levenger for Mr. Abraham, who does business under the name of Paddle Tramps Manufacturing. This case calls for the Court to fill in a gap between two of its previous opinions that deal with the interplay between latches and permanent injunctions in trademark cases. On the one hand, we have the Armco case from 1982, which holds that there is no doubt that latches may defeat claims for injunctive relief in a trademark case. On the other hand, we have Conan Properties from 1985, which holds that a finding of latches alone ordinarily will not bar a claim for injunctive relief in a trademark case. So the question here is, under what circumstances will latches on the part of a trademark owner rise to the level that will bar injunctive relief in a trademark case?
What's the name of the first case? Conan is the second case. What's the first case?
Armco burglary, yes. And the answer to the question is this, that if the circumstances of the latches in this case do not rise to the level that will bar injunctive relief, then frankly, it's difficult for me to even imagine a case where it will. You would render latches a dead letter if this were not the case that would bar injunctive relief. What I'd like to do is first discuss the aggravating circumstances, or some courts call them plus factors, that are present in this case that bar injunctive relief. And then I'd like to address the three errors that the district court made in ordering injunctive relief, notwithstanding the jury's findings of latches, acquiescence, and many other important things. There are, in my view, at least five plus factors in this case that either alone or in combination impose a bar to injunctive relief as a matter of law. First, and probably most importantly, we have an extraordinarily long period of delay in this case. The delay of 40 years found by the jury is one of the longest in the annals of trademark jurisprudence. The last 18 years of that delay, from 1990 to the time they brought suit in 2008, is particularly egregious, because that was a period in which they were sending very sporadic letters. They'd start with a form licensing letter. They'd follow it up sometime later with a threat, a cease and desist type threat. More time would pass, and then they'd come up with a very friendly reminder. And as the court below found, the long period over which the Greek organization sent letters threatening litigation only reinforced the impression that they would not take legal action to protect the marks. The court found that, and I think it's very, very significant, because it makes this case virtually identical to the Burney case.
Mr. Leminger, there's a couple of things that bother me about this statement. And the first one is that the infringing behavior was supposedly about 2.5 of your client's business. That's number one. And number two, that the royalty back then may have been $5, I guess, per
very small
organization.
Right,
and
right.
How does that factor in with this first long period of delay?
Well, I don't think it factors in at all, Your Honor, and here's why. They were essentially arguing progressive encroachment, the idea that the infringement was too minimal and only later did it rise to a significant level. The jury rejected that.
Yeah.
And
But what you're saying is these are aggravated circumstances.
Right.
Aggravated circumstances.
Plus factors.
And these two factors don't cut in favor of aggravation. It cuts almost against aggravation. That is to say, they made a business decision, you know, why waste for $5 per organization? It's cost effective not to go to trial.
Well, the problem with that argument is multitude, but one is that it focuses only on dollar amount and not the likelihood of harm.
Okay.
That's the key. Or the likelihood of confusion. And back in 1990, 1995, they started realizing that there was arguably a likelihood of confusion. And in 1995, they sent a cease and desist letter to my client and very unequivocally said, you must cease and you must desist. We ignored it. They followed it up years later with another such cease and desist, and they sat on their rights for 18 years. That's why I say it's aggravating. It doesn't have anything to do with the dollar amount.
There's one other element of this case that's different from almost every other. Generally speaking, when it comes to us, it's like some small company is, say, copying the Ford logo, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm familiar with that case.
Okay.
Right.
Now, Ford is a big organization that wants purity and wants control. These organizations are not your typical commercial organizations that have those same interests. Now, yes, they want to protect their mark, their insignia, whatever.
Right.
But it doesn't have the same factors. It hasn't. These are two horribly different types of organizations. Does that play anyway in this analysis?
I don't think so, Your Honor. They offered a panoply of excuses. One of which was that we're nonprofit organizations and we're not litigious. That may be the point you're making. The court put the burden on us to negate all their conceivable excuses, and we did negate them all. The jury answered no. And as to the non-litigiousness argument, the evidence was to the contrary. Defendant's Exhibit 783 was a list of the lawsuits that the Greek organizations, Singular and some combination, had brought over the years for trademark infringement. And in many instances, they were suing people smaller than paddle tramps. So I think, based on that, the jury rejected the so-called we're not litigious excuse. I think another, back on the lengthy, egregious period of delay, I think the pattern of letter writing campaign of threatening, then not threatening, then politely requesting, is truly a laches plus. It rises almost to the level of an acquiescence and maybe even an estoppel. So I think that's significant, and it likens this case to the Bernie case. We talked briefly about excuse. There really was no conceivable excuse. They argued progressive encroachment. The jury rejected that, and I think the evidence supported that because the evidence showed that we had never, never expanded or intensified our use of the marks in any way. Then they argued somewhat inconsistently, very inconsistently, I think, that the infringement was just too de minimis. This maybe goes to your point, Judge Garza, just too de minimis to even justify the suit. The problem is paddle tramps, they admitted, is one of the largest manufacturers of Greek products in the country.
Yeah, but that's a relative term. I mean, it's a relative description. One of the greatest, really?
Well,
I mean, it's a small company, and the infringement is 2.5% or less of the total business.
Well, I don't think we should get sidetracked with that 2-point-some percent because the testimony was unequivocal that even though the infringing products represent a small amount, they drive the sales of our other products. And that's why I think they were taking the position as early as 1995 that there was a likelihood of confusion. It's just that they sat on their rights for all those years.
Go ahead and get to the fifth one, and then I want to ask you one question on Conan.
Sure.
What's the fifth after?
The fifth what?
Fifth. Factor. I thought
well,
five.
I was on two, the extraordinarily long delay, the lack of any excuse, both reliance and undue prejudice, which I think is significant because in Conan, the court talked in terms of laches barring injunctive relief if you have either reliance or undue prejudice. Here the jury found both. Fourth would be the lack of any bad faith on our part. To be sure, the court found infringement. But the jury found the absence of any unclean hands, and I think there's ample evidence to support that. In fact, the court found that the evidence was contrary to any notion that paddle tramps acted with unclean hands. And fifth, and I think very importantly, there's just no harm here to either the Greeks, to their consumers, or to the public from the use of these marks. Now, as to the Greeks, I think they catch themselves coming and going. They admit they take the position that any harm from paddle tramps' use doesn't loom large enough to even justify the suit. Of course, the jury rejected that, but to that I say, if it doesn't loom large enough to even justify the suit, then what's the point of an injunction that so radically transforms the way in which this company is doing business and has done business for the last 50 years? They can't have it both ways. They can't say that the harm is so minimal as to even justify a suit, and then turn it around and say, oh, but we have unclean hands and we need a comprehensive injunction here. It just doesn't square for me at all.
Mr. Leventer, in Conan, the following is found, I guess, in page 152. A finding of laches alone ordinarily will not bar the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief, although it, it typically will foreclose a demand for an accounting or damages. And this is the important part. This is because courts construe the plaintiff's unreasonable delay to imply consent to the defendant's conduct, which amounts to nothing more than a revocable license. The license is revoked once the plaintiff objects to the defendant's infringement. Now, under that theory, why shouldn't we affirm the injunction in this case? Well, they just revoke your license, and let's proceed the way it should go.
Two answers, Judge Garza. One is that particular language is referring to acquiescence, not to latches. It's referring to
acquiescence. No, it says a finding of latches alone will not bar, and then it gives the revocation. This is exactly I just read this right out of Conan.
Right. Well, the revocation language in context refers to acquiescence, but then the court goes on to say, and this is important, I can't remember if it's on page 152 or 153, but then it says, but an injunction should be denied if there's reliance, either reliance or undue prejudice.
Where are you reading? I want to make sure that you're reading this correctly. Where are you reading?
I better grab the opinion.
When you come back, you can read it to us.
Yeah, but it's not, I think on page 152 or 153 in the left-hand column of the opinion.
So how is your client, in what way is your client adversely affected by the injunction or prejudiced, or how is it affecting the business?
Very adversely affected, Judge Prado, because it radically transforms the way in which they've been doing business for 50 years now. We're restricted from using the names and the marks of the Greek organizations in advertising.
But you can still use the Greek letters. You just can't use them in the form in the right order to name specific fraternities or sororities, but you can still use the Greek letters in your advertising.
You can use individual Greek letters, but individually they mean nothing. They have to be used in combination. So you can't say, for example, you we're allowed under the injunction to manufacture these double raised crests, but we can't identify the double raised crests with the name of the organization. We can't say.
In other words, it screws up the whole pattern of ordering these, because if somebody says Delta Tau Epsilon instead of Delta Tau Delta in their order by accident, then you're going to send them the wrong thing, and it completely messes up the way in which people order something, right?
Right. Yes, it's ordering, it's marketing, it's advertising, it's really crippled them,
The question I had, I know you have a lot of testimony about that, but the question I had is, why couldn't you fellows, if this is such a small thing, why couldn't you fellows have just resolved this by some sort of licensing agreement?
Right.
Why are we here?
Well, we're here, Your Honor, because Paddle Tramps has historically, dating back to the 1990 when they first came up with a formal licensing campaign, is very much opposed to it because of the issue of control. They don't want the Greek organizations telling them what they can and cannot manufacture. There are a number of Greek organizations that don't, that won't license decorative paddles, which is a huge problem. They've said all along the money, the small royalty, Judge Garza, is not the issue here. It's the control you're giving
up. But they have the right to control this mark. Now, whether or not they've acted on that right, that it's their mark. It's not your mark.
Sure.
It's not your client's mark. And in fact, in some respects, your client has been using somebody else's mark for the last, 40, 50 years through inaction and only inaction, or whatever, however you want to characterize it.
Well, I think it's more than inaction, Judge Garza. When you've got 18 years of letters where sometimes they threaten, then they back off and they're very polite about it. I think this is just.
You have a jury finding of acquiescence, do you not?
Yes, implied acquiescence. We do, and we got a jury finding of reliance, undue prejudice, 40 years of delay.
Reading from Conan at page 152, the jury's affirmative finding of acquiescence establishes the reliance necessary to preclude the issuance of an injunction.
Right.
But in one market, anyway.
Right. right. And then the court went on in the language I was recounting to Judge Garza to say that an injunction is properly denied. May I finish my answer here, Judge Brown?
Go ahead.
An injunction is properly denied when you have either reliance or undue prejudice.
But does that preclude what the judge did in this case? It may establish if he had gone the other way, but does it preclude him from enjoining future sales?
Yes, because he misapplied the law. He didn't look at the jury findings in their broader significance as plus factors, and he misallocated the burden of proof very significantly. He put the burden on us to show a second time a lack of prejudice when we'd already proven it in connection with latches. The case law, particularly a case out of the Third Circuit, it would impose the burden upon them to negate prejudice. And further, the court did not put the burden on them under the eBay case to prove that an injunction would not disturb the public interest. So we have a couple things. We have a misallocation of the burden of proof. We have a failure to view the factors as in their broader context. And then we have the court absolutely ignoring the uncontroverted evidence of harm. So we have clear error. We really have a misapplication of the law to a clearly erroneous view of the facts.
Thank you, Mr. Clevenger. Mr. Wheat.
May it please the court, Jack Wheat for the Greek Organizations. We're losing sight about how little was enjoined here. They testified for an entire week at trial that the most important product was the decal of the fraternity and sorority crest. They said that's what drove the sales, the decal with the crest, the coat of arms of the fraternity or sorority. That is a lawful product. Paddle Tramps gets those decals from one of our licensed vendors. They are allowed to resell the lawful licensed product. That is not an infringement. They are not infringed from selling those decals. Judge Ferguson went so far as to say, and they can advertise those decals by the name of the fraternity or sorority.
Well, they're saying that it did have a big effect on how they do business and how they advertise.
All we've noticed is that they had to remove some ads from their website. They couldn't use the fraternity insignia or sorority insignia to advertise their products.
But that flies in the face of the jury's verdict of acquiescence and reliance, doesn't it?
Well, the jury found implicit acquiescence, Your Honor. They did not find explicit acquiescence.
What do you mean by implicit acquiescence? What was the jury issue?
There were two acquiescence issues submitted to the jury. Implicit, was it our silence alone that made them believe it was all right to continue selling these products? The explicit acquiescence issue was whether we did anything to affirmatively indicate to them that it was proper to continue selling this merchandise. The jury did not find explicit acquiescence. All they found was implicit acquiescence, which was an issue that didn't even need to go to the jury. As the Supreme
Court... Does Conan's or Armco turn on whether it's explicit or implicit acquiescence?
I think that Conan very definitely does, Your Honor. And I'll refer you to page 152 in Conan. In Conan, even, it recites the general rule. A finding of latches ordinarily will not bar the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief. So we're saying a finding of latches, a finding of undue delay, unnecessary delay, a finding of undue prejudice. That's not enough. ordinarily will not bar the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief. It will bar a request for monetary relief. And Conan cites the Menendez. That was the quote I was getting ready to read to the court. Because courts construe the delay to imply consent, which is revoked when you say, no, please stop doing that. But in Conan, it was explicit acquiescence. The end of that very paragraph, where the defendant actually relies upon plaintiff's affirmative acts. The fiction of implied consent was inapplicable. In Conan, the owner of the mark said, good luck, I hope you do well. Had his picture taken with the owner of the pizza parlor. Sent it back with an autograph, said, best wishes, good luck. In Conan, there was explicit acquiescence, not implicit acquiescence.
Wasn't gone for 18 to 40 years, though.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It probably did not go on for 18 to 40 years.
Well, in the University of Pittsburgh, it went on for 44 years, Your Honor, where the Champion Sporting Goods Company was producing shirts with Pitt or the Pitt Panther logo, started in 1936, and the University of Pittsburgh did not complain until 1980. And the Third Circuit said, relying on this court's pro hockey case, that you've invested in the business. You know, your investment in the Capitals not injured. What you need to stop doing is selling the Pitt specific merchandise. That was 44 years. That was longer than what we have here.
Somewhere, you know, was there evidence in this case of whether or not across the United States this type of mark became commercially viable at any period of time, which would then increase the desire to protect the mark, or because of the internet and that instrument of sale, that it became then more important to protect the mark? Was there any evidence of either of those two?
You're referring to our marks, not the Pitt mark, Your Honor?
Your marks.
I think here's what the evidence.
Or for instance, Pittsburgh, the athletic departments. You know, back in the 60s, nobody sold any of that stuff, or it was very, very small from the bookstore. Now it's become almost a major aspect of every athletic department.
I think in the collegiate market, it did become more significant in the 1980s, Your Honor. You know, as silk screening became more efficient and expensive, and people could pump out these shirts quickly and easily. Evidence here what we have, it's like you and your neighbor, Your Honor. Your neighbor comes over and borrows your hammer without your permission. He brings it back, maybe. Maybe not. Maybe you have to go get your hammer back. He keeps doing it. You keep saying, I'll give you permission, but please request permission. Please quit walking into my garage and borrowing my hammer. That's what we have here. Who knows when the Greeks became aware of paddle tramps? One organization was aware of them in 68, the one that's headquartered in Arlington, Texas. But the other 31, who knows when they became aware of paddle tramps? But what they did was said, please get permission. Please apply for a license. Your products are fine. We're happy to consider you for licensing. Your neighbor keeps borrowing your hammer. You keep saying, please stop. Please get permission. Are you supposed to invest $1 million in a federal lawsuit over a $5 hammer, over a $140 hammer? You know. The latches delay period doesn't begin to run when the infringement is de minimis. Today, it's $140 per organization per year. That's the average. Today, the effect of the internet, prior to the internet.
You're saying, wait. You know, now we're getting into a lot of things. If it's $140 per organization per year, they're saying it's control over the use of the marks.
As well as it should be. They are.
Well, what is the nature? So don't just tell us what's the full extent. What is the full extent of the control then? If they were to license, well, I still don't understand why both sides are investing $1 million in this litigation, because obviously you must want to do something about their business, and that means something to your organizations, and they must feel that there's a systemic threat. So what is it that you would control?
I'll tell you what the real flashpoint was with Greek organizations. And it was about 1990, and it's when the silk screen event T-shirts became very prevalent around college campuses, and college boys in fraternities, college girls in fraternities were using these shirts to advertise parties. And a lot of them got awfully sexist and racist, glorifying alcohol, glorifying drugs.
What's that got to do with Mr. Bruce Wheat? What has that got to do with paddle trams?
Well, and that's actually
they're not selling T-shirts.
It's more It's more responsive to Judge Garza's question of what was the flashpoint that made the Greeks more concerned about, hey, these are our marks, these are our image, we need to get a handle on how they're being used. We need to and we want to control our marks.
But there's no concern of that nature here, where paddle tramps was improperly using the Greek letters to somehow offend the fraternity.
Your Honor, and your law clerk could find a million cases that says even if it's great quality, if you're using the marks without permission, it's still an infringement.
That's not the question that I asked you, Mr. Weed. What is the control that the Greeks are attempting to exert in exchange for a license?
The control is have the products approved prior to going to the market.
Well, he said that some of them would not allow the sale of paddles.
And it's not an issue with those. If the paddles aren't accustomed with the sorority, they're not going to be buying the paddles anyway, so there's no need to get them licensed. Paddle tramps products.
I don't understand why you all are fighting about. I really don't, because if this is still such a tiny amount of money, on the one hand, but you've been sitting on it for 40 years, and on their side, they claim, am I wrong that this, if you have to order everything Delta, 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 first of all, there's no key on your computer to order Delta, 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 and therefore they're not allowed to do an icon of Delta, Delta, Delta. So I don't know how they're even gonna have computerized orders.
Well, and again, Your Honor,
is that right, or is that factually wrong?
No, I think that's factually wrong, Your Honor, and the reason that's factually wrong is Judge Ferguson allows them to continue advertising the crest by name, by trademark. They have a drop-down menu on their website saying which organization's crest do you want. And then the next drop down might be, do you want the Greek letters also? But they've already said which organization it is. Do you want, a little brother, a little wooden piece, or a little sister? Do you want any other generic symbols? Do you want a star? Do you want a rainbow? Do you want a giraffe? Do you want a balloon? All those are selections that can be made on their website. Their website's not their, I don't know what percentage of their business it is, but for most of their history, their business was supplying component parts to other shops, college stores, craft shops. You'll see it in our record excerpts. Behind tab 5, that would be exhibit 381, that shows a standard display. Blank paddles, that's not an infringement. That's a shelf with a lot of bins, so you select the component parts you want for your product. Here they have picture frames if you want to decorate a picture frame.
Well, you're going to go to Michael's to get all that stuff unless you can get a kit that is designed for your fraternity or sorority. So I really don't. 2.5% is the. I can understand why the testimony supports that. That's the fulcrum of the business.
And that's.
But you're trying to shut it down. And again, I'm saying, what is the extent of the control that you receive? There must be more than $140 a year in the nature of the control that you were seeking.
Your Honor, I'm ashamed to be here. I didn't want to sue my neighbor for borrowing my hammer. For 15 years, over 30 letters, we said, please take a license. If you're not going to take a license, please cease and desist. We're not litigious. The Greek organizations are nonprofit organizations.
I assume that maybe they were going into the paddle business themselves.
No, Your Honor. We just want to get a handle on our trademarks. They're our property. We have the right to control our property. Prior to the internet, they weren't really using our insignia to advertise the products. It was a display. You walk into the store, buy the components you want. Their standard display in 381 would have three demo paddles to give you ideas of how you could decorate one. They don't have to use any of our insignia for their demo paddles. There are scores and scores and scores of fraternities, or they could use a fictional one for that matter. You know, the famous Gamma Delta Iota, not really a fraternity, but a term used in the industry, and a student can look at it and go, yeah, I can make one of those in my organization. They're allowed to do that. We're not putting paddle tramps out of business. We just don't want them using our insignia to advertise their products. Prior to the internet, they didn't much. Most of their ads were pretty generic prior to the internet. Exhibit 564, Greek gifts. Just have some drawings of some things without using anyone's particular insignia. Exhibit.
Should I ask what these paddles are used for? I'm sure that hazing is improper and they're in no way used.
We hope they're not used for hazing, Your Honor. But the internet, what that changed is now they're advertising using the insignia. You know, when you walk into the store, you can select the components you want. But when they went to the internet, they started prevalent use of our marks to advertise the products.
Why can't a disclaimer accomplish your objective here?
Well, Boston Pro Hockey from this circuit says when you're totally replicating a mark, a disclaimer is probably not going to be very effective.
Did you have findings of acquiescence and delay in that case?
Your Honor, no, but the
that was just a question of whether there was an infringement, I think.
Right. But the fact is, you know, disclaimers aren't considered to be a very effective remedy. We know this circuit has allowed it when you're trying to balance the conflict between the First Amendment and someone's trademark rights. But that's not what we have here. I liked their cite to the Second Circuit Soltex case, which said, okay, disclaimer might be all right here. But in that case, it wasn't a clear case of infringement. And what I want to point your attention to is what the Second Circuit said more recently in Pro Fitness Physical Therapy 314 F3rd 62, Second Circuit 2002. It refers to the Soltex case from 1987. And to quote the Second Circuit in Pro Fitness, they say, quote, however, we also have noted that while disclaimers may prevent consumer confusion, A growing body of academic literature has concluded that disclaimers, especially those which employ brief negator words such as no or not, are generally ineffective. Some citations, then the quote continues. Such disclaimers might be effective to cure a minimal or moderate amount of confusion, but a case involving more substantial confusion requires more. And that's what we have here, clear confusion, not a situation of maybe...
All Greek to me.
Excuse me?
Nothing.
All Greek to me.
He said it was confusion. Now.
Judge Jones, back to your question again. The problem with disclaimer here is the doctrine of initial interest confusion. Someone's out surfing the internet, they get lured into an internet site, they're looking at the products thinking, yeah, I think I want one of those, and then you go, and then you say, well, by the way, this isn't official product. Is the consumer likely to go, oh, and back out and commence a search again? It's what this court more specifically said in the Elvis case, said if you're lured into the restaurant because of the infringement, you know, you're seated at your table, you find out it's not an official Elvis restaurant, it's not affiliated with his estate or his heirs, are you going to stand up and leave and go to a different restaurant? You're already in there. The initial interest confusion lured you into the establishment. It's too late for a disclaimer then. The damage was already done.
The district court didn't write about a disclaimer, though, did he?
No, the court very, very much so paid attention to the disclaimer issue. It did come up. It was addressed in the decision, and the court held that a disclaimer would not be effective here. So it certainly had the authority not to require a disclaimer, and I don't think it can be said that there was an abuse to so hold.
Thank you, Mr. Wheat.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think, frankly, we've heard a lot of the same jury argument that the jury heard and the jury rejected consistently throughout the verdict, and I'll turn to that in a moment. But first, I want to return to Conan, where it was not an explicit acquiescence case. Footnote 3 describes verbatim the charge that was given to the jury on acquiescence, and it was implied acquiescence instruction. Now, here's the language that I was referring to with Judge Garza. It's on page 153.
Mr. Smith.
If you're looking at a West version, it's in the left-hand column down towards the bottom of page 153.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And we've quoted it several times in our brief. It's an important quote because it says, an injunction against future infringement in a particular locale when latches and acquiescence have been found, as in this case, and I would add as in our case, is properly denied if the plaintiff's delay or other conduct either induced reliance on the defendant's part or will result in substantial prejudice to the defendant if the plaintiff is permitted to enforce its rights in the trademark. So it was for that reason that the court held that the latches and the acquiescence barred the injunction, barred any kind of injunction in the Austin area. But in Conan, the court went on to say that that latches would and acquiescence would not bar the expanded use of the mark in the San Antonio area. And here in our case, we have no expansion. The use of the marks has been consistent from the very beginning, from the foundation of this company back in the 60s. They argue that it only started with the internet. Not true at all. The names and the marks of the Greek organizations had been used consistently starting in the 60s by paddle tramps in catalogs, in brochures, and you can see some of those in our record excerpts. So there was no expansion as was the case in Conan, that resulted in the grant of an injunction outside of the Austin area. They consistently confuse the amount of sales and the royalty with the real issue in this case, which is the extensive use of the marks, that that the marks only produce X amount in sales or would produce only Y amount in royalties is just irrelevant, because the point is the extensive use. And they obviously recognized that back in the 90s when they began sending cease and desist letters, only to sit on their hands for another 15 to 18 years, which makes this case very different from all the others they cite. They purport to know more about our business than we know about our business, which is simply not so. The evidence is uncontroverted from Ken Abraham and Kyle Abraham about the extreme harm from this injunction, and that evidence was at trial. It was at the time the court was considering the remedy, and it was at the time the court had before it our motion for stay. And I've described that evidence in detail on pages 32 to 34 of our brief, and it largely, not largely, it is not controverted by the other side. They cannot controvert our evidence that the injunction is extremely harmful in terms of the website. We cannot show the paddle kits the way we used to. It's just wrong to suggest otherwise.
Mr. Leminger, I thought in Conan, that what you just finished reading, it says an injunction against future infringement in a particular locale. You talk right about a particular locale. Now, to what extent does that extend to this situation? Conan seems to be a locale type of case.
It was limited to those facts, but in our case, Paddle Tramps had a nationwide business by the 1990s, actually long before that. So we were already doing business on a nationwide basis using their names and marks. And that's why the other aspect of the Conan case, which involved the injunction against the expansion into San Antonio, is inapplicable here, because that was a type of progressive encroachment in Conan's. We don't have that here.
Before you conclude, would you please just say, are you arguing solely that Judge Ferguson abused his discretion, or is your fundamental argument that he misapplied the law, and exactly what he misapplied?
Right. Our argument is that he abused his discretion under the Peaches formulation by misapplying the law to a clearly erroneous view of the facts. And he misapplied the law by not giving the jury findings their broader context as plus factors, by misallocating the burden of proof, by, I think, giving very, very short shrift to the possibility of a disclaimer, which we talked about in our brief. This case is distinguishable, very distinguishable from the Boston Hockey case. And then finally, he clearly erred, even apart from the misallocation of the burden of proof, in finding that we had not shown prejudice as a result of the injunction. We did show, I think the evidence was uncontroverted, that we did show harm from the prospect of an injunction.
Thank you, Mr. Levenger.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all.